Okay, so in today's lecture, we're going to continue on the theme of collective behavior, and we're going to start considering animal behavior and then finally move on to human behavior in this and the last lecture of the class. And so animal behavior, you know, when we see these types of patterns, as we discussed in the previous lecture, we can understand the local processes, the local interactions among individuals that give rise to these large-scale collective behaviors. And so here is just a representation, a sort of schematic of how these local interactions may arise among individuals. So if you recall, it's local repulsion among individuals and a longer range tendency to be attracted and to align direction of travel with near neighbors. And that's what gives rise to the types of patterns and group structures that you see here. And so, previously, I emphasized that one doesn't need to have a leader or a choreographer to coordinate these types of motions. It can arise through a process of self-organization among the local interactions between the individuals. However, there can, in addition, be processes that do lead to leadership among individuals within groups. And so, in the first part of today's lecture, I want to focus on how groups of animals can make informed, unanimous decisions about where to go. Because, of course, they have to come to consensus about what to do to not to lose the benefits of group living. Leaving the group can be very dangerous. And so I'm going to show you pictures of fish just because I have them, but we can think of ungulates, and you know, I'll even show you groups of humans behave in a similar way. So what this represents is that this individual here has information. It has goal-oriented information. It knows, for example, that there's a food source over here, or perhaps this is a section of a migration route, or perhaps it knows that there's a predator over there and it wants to move away and the others do not know this. So how can this individual convey information, or how can others benefit from the information it has? Does it need to signal to other individuals? I know what I'm doing, follow me. But we have no evidence that they do so. Do other individuals need to recognize this individual, know who he or she is, in order to benefit from this information? Again, we have no evidence for this in experimental systems. And so one way to address this is to come up with a very simple model. Because as I explained before, it's very difficult through verbal argument alone to explain how and why individuals behave in the way they do. And it's important for you to know that when I use color here, this is so we know who the informed individuals are. There is no way of inferring who is informed or who is not informed. They can't read the minds of other individuals. And we assume that this individual here follows a social tendency, the flocking tendency or the schooling tendency or the grouping tendency exhibited by animals. And it balances this grouping tendency, the schooling tendency, with this goal-oriented information with a simple weighting term that we call omega. Now, omega is a continuous parameter. So if omega is zero, this individual, the vector length of its goal-oriented information represented by G, doesn't have any influence on its behavior. If omega becomes very high, then this term, the goal-oriented term, dominates and its social tendency will be much, much weaker. And so this is an example of when the goal-oriented tendency becomes very, very high and it would dominate over the social tendency. And so we can consider whether this individual, without signaling, without individual recognition, can actually influence others within the group. And so let's consider a preferred direction by the informed individuals. And it's just simply to move from the left to the right. And I'll show you a group of 100 individuals where we have one informed individual, five informed individuals, and 10 informed individuals. And you can see that one informed individual, the green cross just represents the center of the group, the centroid, and you can see that this individual cannot influence the group. The group is not moving in that preferred direction. However, if we turn to five informed individuals, after an initial period where the informed individuals, which are colored white here, go to the edge of the group, the frontal edge, you can see that the group kind of moves in the right direction, but it's sort of noisy. However, if we have 10 informed individuals, you can see suddenly and almost spontaneously the group moves very accurately in that direction. I want to emphasize again, there is no recognition of who is informed and who's not informed. There's no signaling. The informed individuals aren't telling others that they're informed. And yet spontaneously, the information can convey across the group. And so we can quantify the accuracy of information transfer from a value of 0, which means no information transfer, the group will move in random directions, to a value of 1 where there's perfect information transfer and the group moves exactly in that direction. And you can see that as the proportion of informed individuals increases, regardless of the group size, the accuracy suddenly and very steeply increases for small proportions of informed individuals. So a very small proportion of individuals within the group can very accurately convey information to others. Something perhaps even more interesting than that is that if we, for example, choose 85% accuracy, we see that for a small group, a group of 10, to have that level of accuracy, we need around 50% of the individuals to have this information. However, as we go to a larger group, such as a group of 200, to have the same accuracy of information transfer, we now need less than 5% of the individuals within the group. And if we simulate migrating groups, for example, where there can be tens of thousands of individuals, this can actually reduce to an infinitesimal proportion of the individuals. And yet to the observer, to the biologist observing groups on the move, it looks to us as if everybody has information, because we can't see inside the minds of these individuals. But of course, in many cases, information is costly or difficult to obtain. And so we may predict, if that's the case, that in actual fact, only a small proportion of individuals actually know where to go. So this, of course, is theory. This is a computational model that makes predictions. But we want to then test these predictions. And so we've done so using schooling fish. So these are real animals. It's not a simulation. The red individuals have been trained to associate a green laser with a reward. The fish naturally have no response to this laser unless they're trained. And you could see that there was this wave of information transfer that propagates across the group. So the red individuals are randomly located. They're the informed individuals. The laser goes on, and this individual sees it, and then you get this sudden transmission of information across the group. So we can see that indeed a small proportion of individuals, without telling others what to do, can convey the information to them. And also, experimentally, we find that we need only a very small proportion of these individuals to convey information to others. So if you watch this again, you can see this wave of information transfer. And if we look at the number of informed individuals we need, only a very small number are required to accurately convey this information. So far, our informed individuals have all been in agreement about where to go. But of course, in many groups, there can be conflict or disagreement about where to go or what to do. For example, some individuals may want to move this way, and other individuals disagree and want to move in a different direction. But remember, leaving the group means the individuals lose the benefits of group living, and it can be extremely risky. So we want to ask the question, can these individuals within a group come to a collective consensus decision? Now, when we think about consensus decision-making among humans, of course, we can vote, and we can tally those votes, we can count those votes, and work out what the majority is. But these individuals, of course, cannot do that. But nevertheless, can they come to a consensus? Now, what's going to matter here is not just the number of individuals that want to move in each direction. What's also going to matter is how strongly they want to move in that direction. But also important is the actual geometry of the decision-making process. What do I mean by that? Well, of course, the angle at which they disagree, which represents the degree to which they disagree, could be very important. If we consider 0 degrees here, that means there's no disagreement. That's exactly what I just showed you before, when all the leaders are agreed about which direction to travel in. But they may disagree by a small amount, such as 10 degrees or 20 degrees, all the way up to 180 degrees, where they actually want to go in opposite directions. And so I'm going to keep one group, subset one, always wanting to go 0 degrees, which is the same direction you just saw before. And then I'm going to change the angle at which the other group disagrees with them. And that's represented by the top dotted line. So the subgroup one is always 0 degrees, that's the bottom dotted line. Subgroup two may differ by 10, 20, 30 degrees, all the way up to 180 degrees, where they want to go in opposite directions. And for each value, for each degree of difference, I'll run thousands of simulations and work out where does the group go. And I'm just showing, for simplicity, the solid white line in the middle, which shows the average direction. Not that the individuals could calculate that, but it shows you the average direction between these two subgroups. And so I'll look at 5 individuals wanting to go one way and 5 individuals disagreeing and wanting to go in a different direction. And what we see is that up to a critical difference of opinion, the group spontaneously averages the opinions of individuals. The group goes in the average direction. But above this critical angle, suddenly we see consensus being made. This is not the group splitting. Half of the time the group goes this way, and half of the time the group moves in the other direction. And so below that critical difference, if this angle is small enough, the group will spontaneously move in the average direction. But as this angle increases and it reaches that critical point, now the group will randomly go one way or the other. So it's moving from averaging to consensus decision making. And of course, if you imagine the group moving towards real targets in space, if those targets are far away, the angle will be small. But as you approach them and get closer and closer, the angle increases. And so the group should be expected to spontaneously move in the average direction and then come to consensus and go one way or the other. And that is exactly what we find in these simulations. Now, what if we don't have 5 against 5? What if we change it so we have 6 individuals that prefer to go one way, 5 that want to go another way, and the group has to come to consensus? So it's only 1% of total group size that's different here. Now, we could calculate this. So we have 1% of total group size. So we have 6 individuals wanting to go one way and 5 that want to go in a different direction. Now, we could calculate this. I could ask you a question. I could count how many responses I have and calculate this answer. But these individuals cannot do so. So now, instead of 5 versus 5, we have 6 that want to go one way versus 5 that want to go another way. And what we see is when we reach this consensus, the group spontaneously adopts the majority preferred direction. Even though the individuals can't recognize who has information, and of course they cannot count. So spontaneously, these groups are voting on the move. And it's actually the fluid-like nature of these groups that contributes to this collective computation. So now, as before, if the angle is sufficiently small, the group will move in the average direction. But when we reach this critical difference, the group will now choose the majority preferred direction. So I'll show you some simulations running here. So there's an equal number of individuals that want to get to the white and the red target, and the group will randomly choose which target. In this case, they chose the red target. But if I ran this again, it would be random which one they chose. But if I add just one extra individual, so 1% of total group size, and you can see from the simulation the noisy local nature of the interactions, yet the group will almost always choose the majority preferred target. So they're extremely good at voting, even though no individual can count. However, if their preference becomes too strong, then the white and the red individuals are unwilling to give up on the directions they want to travel, and the group will tend to split. But in a large regime, the group comes to a consensus decision. And it may be surprising, but humans also behave in the same way. If you don't know where to go, if you're at a music festival or something like this, you will tend to follow the motion of other individuals within the crowd. And so here we did an experiment in a football stadium in Germany where we have a small number of informed individuals that know where to go and a large number of uninformed individuals, but nobody is actually verbally communicating, but the small number of informed individuals can accurately guide the group, can convey the information, again, without language or signaling. Now, consensus is a very important aspect of decision making. As I mentioned, it means individuals do not lose the benefits of group living. But consensus can also be under situations where there are conflicting interests among members of the group. For example, if you're on a hiring committee and nobody can come to a consensus about whom to hire, this could be very bad for the business or the university in which it occurs. And so we have typically within these groups selfish individuals, individuals that are genetically not related to one another, and yet they have to come to a consensus decision. So when we have one subset that wants to go in a certain direction and another subset that disagrees with them, you may ask yourself whether this subset could just increase the strength of their opinion. Could that then exert their influence on the other members of the group? And so here we're going to look at a scenario where there are six individuals that want to go one direction and five individuals that disagree with them and want to move in a different direction. So I'm going to fix the majority preference arbitrarily to 0.3. And now I'm going to show you what happens when the minority, if they have an equal strength of preference, 0.3, you can see the majority wins with probability 1, which means 100% of the time. But as the minority becomes more strongly opinionated, they begin to exert their influence on the group. And 0.5 here means that half of the time, it's 50%, half of the time the majority wins, and half of the time the minority wins. But if the minority becomes sufficiently opinionated, if the strength of their preference is high enough, they can exert their influence on the group, and the group moves in their direction. So this appears to show that the stronger your opinion in collective decision making, the more likely you are to win out. So it's a good thing, right? But this is also means that the group is more likely to split apart. But this is the case where all of the individuals in the group have a preference. What about, as in many cases, we have individuals within the group that don't know what's going on? Or they know what's happening, And they do not have a preference regarding whether to go left or right. Now, previously, people had always thought that these uninformed individuals will just act as noise. They won't change the decision-making process itself. But what we find is that they do, and quite dramatically. And so now what we're looking at on the x-axis is the percentage of uninformed individuals within the group. And now the minority, the smaller number of individuals, has a stronger preference. It's 0.38 versus the majority, 0.3. But it's not so strong, because we can see that with no uninformed individuals, the majority still wins 60% of the time. But look, if we put in 10 or 12 stupid or uninformed individuals, we spontaneously push control further to the majority. If everybody, of course, is uninformed, the group can no longer make accurate decisions. And I can increase this minority preference strength further and further still. Now, the minority are so strongly opinionated that they will win 98% of the time. The majority will only win around 2% of the time. But if I add, again, 12 stupid individuals or uninformed individuals, individuals that you may not expect to contribute to the decision-making process, you can see that we push control to the majority. They're not aware that they're doing it, but the uninformed individuals are promoting democratic decision-making. So the strength of preference doesn't matter now. What matters is how many individuals vote one way or the other. And so we've discovered that this is actually a very general principle. It not only explains why in animal groups they can very accurately make decisions, but we also find that in groups of neurons, or even in groups of people, this plays a very important role. And so uninformed or unbiased individuals are very, very important. A small proportion of such individuals increases the probability that groups can reach consensus. So if you imagine if you have two very strongly opinionated subsets, it's hard for them to see eye to eye. However, the uninformed individuals or unbiased individuals act as a sort of social glue that keeps groups together and allows the information to be conveyed between these sort of extreme opinions. They also dramatically increase the speed at which consensus is reached. So again, you'd intuitively think that having uninformed individuals would just slow things down. No, it actually speeds things up. And it increases the sensitivity or the accuracy of consensus decision making. And so we're now exploring whether neurons behave in the same way. Whether in the brain we have sort of unbiased or uninformed neurons that contribute to a neural circuit to allow us to make fast and sensitive decisions. So we're beginning to get evidence that indeed this is the case. So this was initially inspired by how animals interact, but is now telling us how neurons interact. But, you know, I'm a biologist. I never really believe any of this stuff unless we can test it experimentally. And this theory makes a simple and testable prediction that uninformed or unbiased individuals should inhibit the influence of a strongly opinionated minority or extremists and return control to the majority. And so we turned to small schooling fish as a model system in which we could test this. And so we trained individuals to have a preference for either a blue or a yellow target. Now, for the same level of training, they trained much more strongly to yellow. It's an intrinsic color-based learning bias. And so individuals trained to yellow are going to be our strongly opinionated individuals, and individuals trained to blue are weakly opinionated individuals. And of course, we can add fish into the decision-making system who are untrained or who are uninformed. And our theory predicts for these types of groups that a very small number of uninformed individuals should switch decision-making from minority control back to the majority. And experimentally, if we have no uninformed individuals within the group, the strongly opinionated minority dominates the decision-making. But if we now add 5 or 10 uninformed, untrained individuals that, again, naively we think wouldn't change anything, we can see spontaneously they return control to the majority. So as we predicted, these uninformed individuals promote democratic decision-making. They're not aware they're doing so. But it's a very strong effect. Diversity of opinion strengths. Specifically, having individuals in a decision-making system that do not have strong opinions can help come to democratic consensus. And so we wanted to test this not just within our schooling fish, but also in other systems. And here is an olive baboon. So here we have a very complex organism with a sophisticated social life, and it's famous for having very strong hierarchies. Now, how are hierarchies calculated? They're calculated by aggression among the individuals. And if you watch a television documentary, you will often hear that the dominant male will tend to exert his influence on the others and guide the others where to go. But no one has actually tested that. And so working with Ari Strandberg-Peshkin, who's now a junior professor here in Constance, Damien Farin, whom you know, and Mike Crowfoot, who's actually just been offered a position here in Constance, we wanted to test this idea. And so we put GPS collars on all of the adult individuals within a wild baboon troop in Kenya, also with accelerometers. For obvious ethical reasons, we did not put collars on juveniles. And here you're seeing the raw data. The colors just represent whether you're male, female, or a subadult. Turns out not to matter one bit. But look what happens here. Here we can see some individuals wanting to go one way, and other individuals at the bottom here wanting to move in a different direction. But like the fish I described to you earlier, the group will come to consensus regarding where to go. And here we're getting the positions of each individual every second of their lives. And we had tens of thousands of such events where some individuals want to go one way, others want to go in a different direction, and yet the group has to come to consensus. So we can use these data to test our theory of consensus decision making. Firstly, as I mentioned before, we find that social dominance plays absolutely no role in these decisions. Whether you're a dominant male going this way or a subordinate female going this way, it's 50-50. So we do not equate social dominance, which is based on aggression, to influence during movement, at least in this system. And so if you remember, I showed you these plots before, where I changed the angle in preferred directions, and I changed whether there's an equal number that want to go one way or the other, or whether there's slightly more individuals that want to go one way versus the other direction. And we can reconstruct this data from the baboons. And we find that indeed the theory holds. We find very strong evidence. So even though this theory was initially developed for simple animals, it's such an effective means of coming to decisions that we find even very sophisticated organisms, including baboons and even humans, use the same algorithm. But of course, these animals are not living in an empty tank. They're living in a complex, structured environment. So this may look like a photograph, but in fact it's not. This is a three-dimensional point cloud created by a drone that we use to image this environment. And so you can see the river at the top there and the fever trees growing along the river where the baboons like to sleep at night. And we can even zoom in. Here's Damien and Ari and myself, all of us now in Constance, with a drone in Kenya. And so you can see we can zoom in, and you can see highly sophisticated structure here in this three-dimensional scanning of the environment. You can even see the single lane paths that cars and trucks have in this environment. You can see the luggers carved in the road to allow for rainwater to flow out. You can see little bushes up to giant trees. And so we can now put the animals back in the environment in which they've evolved. So we're not just dealing with the social interactions among the individuals, we're now able to consider the complexity of the physical structure of the environment. And you can see as we rotate the world, you can see that the structure clearly plays a role. They come up this path and they're on a ridge, on a plateau. And so the environment is clearly influencing their behavior. So if we just had GPS data, we would not know that. We may think there's a social factor that's driving the group structure, but no, it's the environment. And Ari was able to create a technique that allows us to ask questions regarding the preference landscape for each baboon. We could ask, for example, are they paying attention to those individuals that they can see in this physical environment, the visual landscape? We know that these animals have memory, of course they do. But surprisingly, biologists very rarely consider memory because it's quite complex. As if we could ask, do they have a preference for where they have been before? How does the habitat influence their behavior? You can't move through dense vegetated environment, you'll move around it. And what we discovered, surprisingly, is that the most important factor turns out not to be where the other individuals are now, it's where they have been in the recent past, within about 5 minutes. Even in very dense habitats where individuals can't see each other, they seem to know where others have been. We think this is probably driven by olfaction, by smell. So much like ants laying a chemical trail and other ants following it, it seems the baboons leave a sense of smell as to where they've been, and others smell out where others have been and tend to follow the strongest smell. And this is what allows them to come to a consensus, to choose the majority direction. And so our technique, if we just considered the social interactions, it gives us some information. But if we consider the habitat, how they interact with their physical environment plus their social neighbors, we can get a much stronger prediction of where each individual goes. And this is a non-linear axis, so this is a much, much better prediction about what the individual does, which wouldn't have been possible without this high-dimensional GPS technology that's been developed by Martin Wachelski at the Max Planck and these techniques. And Martin, as many of you may know, has also developed new, smaller, lighter, cheaper tags for animals. One of the great challenges in tagging animals to understand where and how they move is how on earth do you get the tag back to get the data, especially with small animals. But Martin has designed a new instrument that's now on board the International Space Station that will allow us to get the data back pretty much anywhere on the planet. And this is called Icarus. And there's going to be a spacewalk in August by a cosmonaut that will take around 6 hours to put this instrument on the outside of the space station. And then here, for the first time anywhere in the world, we'll be able to track these animals. So Constance really is the epicenter of this type of technology. And Martin and I have been using this technology, for example, to track the motion of storks. These are real data. This is, of course, an animation, but these are real data of how storks are moving within a thermal. They use the thermals to gain lift in their environment. And we've been able to show that exactly as we predicted, there are a small proportion of leaders and a larger proportion of individuals who follow those leaders in these environments. And here you can see individuals are right to leave a thermal. So they're in the thermal now, and they need to make a collective. You can see them moving together, right? And they need to make a collective decision about when to leave and what height to leave this thermal to then explore a new thermal. And here you can see the decision beginning to be made, and they leave. Again, real data collected here in Konstanz. So these are local birds close to Radovsel. This is some of the best data we have on how animals migrate. And we don't have these data just for the local Konstanz area. We have these data for 1,000 kilometers. And we have solar panels on these animals, so we actually know where they go over their entire lifetime. So here you can see the migration from Konstanz across sub-Saharan Africa. So it's an extremely exciting time to do this type of research and to physically be here in Konstanz. Like, we are developing the best technologies in the world for this type of research. We have every wing beat of the animals. We have how they climb the thermals. And because, of course, they're birds and they're buffeted by the environment, we can actually use the subtle details of their movement to reconstruct how the air is actually moving. So we can use the birds as sensors. There's no physical way to do this. Meteorologists can't do this, but we can measure the detailed structure of how the wind moves around the animals. We can look at how they climb thermals and how they move between thermals, and we can do so over the entire lifetime of the animals. And this was published a few weeks ago in Science magazine, which is one of the leading journals. And so, as I showed you before, this is real data. I'm still blown away by this, that we can do this. But sometimes, it's not possible to catch and tag the animals you want. There can be ethical problems, but of course there can be practical problems. Especially, for example, if you want to track animals, in this case in Africa, just having the permissions is almost impossible. And being able to shoot with tranquilizer every individual in a group and tag them is almost impossible. And secondly, in this case, like organisms like zebra or buffalo or gazelle, they don't stay in one group. They move between groups. And so it's very difficult. So what we've developed, or what we're developing, are using drones. So here's a drone that's imaging these buffalo. But the problem with drones is they run out of battery pretty quick. So what you're seeing is the view from another drone that's coming in. It will align its image, and then this one zips back to base station and will recharge it, will change its batteries. And then when this one runs out of batteries, the other one will come back. So we can keep track of these animals. And we also, of course, image the structure in which these animals are moving. So just like I showed you with the baboons, we're able to look at how these organisms are interacting in their natural environments. And we've developed machine learning, neural network software, using deep learning, that can track not just the motion of the individuals, but where they're looking. We can even identify which individual is which. And so really revolutionizing our ability to look at wild animals in natural habitats without even touching them, without tagging them in any way. This whole program has led to a successful grant application to the German government, where we got 32 million euros to build a new building on the campus. And if you've been, this is the TFA, the animal facility, this is the Z building, and you've probably seen the building site on the north part of our campus. This is what's being built. A huge facility that's going to allow us biologists and the computer scientists on campus to work together, to interact, to create the new technologies required to track animals. So we can turn animal behavior into a very quantitative science, much like molecular biology or cell biology has in the past. So this is completely a novel building. There's nowhere else in the world that has this type of facility. And underground, the reason they're digging such a big hole at the moment is underground. There'll be an animal facility, including a huge imaging hangar. This is going to be 15 meters by 15 meters by 8 meters, allowing us to image animals at a scale that's unprecedented, and to get details of who is looking at whom, and even to create virtual reality environments around these organisms. Again, nowhere else in the world can do this. And this building will open in January 2021 here on the campus. So what, if anything, is unique about human culture? Why do we have such complexity of human culture? And complexity is a consequence, it's not an explanation. So can we get some insights into our own lives? So Jeff Galef, back in the early 1990s, suggested that teaching and imitation are unique features that underpin human but not animal cultures. So whereas animal cultures are heavily dependent on local and stimulus enhancement, as Lucy Aplin taught earlier in this course, they're relatively simple compared to the very, very sophisticated features that we have in our lives. And so even though other animals can learn socially from one another, we do so in a very special way. So Tomasello, in 1994, also emphasized the role of imitation in teaching and highlighted the role of a higher fidelity of information transmission, history, language, and perspective taking as unique to human societies. So let's consider teaching first. So of course, I'm trying to teach you today. I'm trying to convey information to you. This requires me to use verbal language for you to comprehend what that means and to memorize it. There is no such teaching within the animal world. So it's where one generation intentionally transmits non-genetic information to unrelated individuals who typically tend to be of a younger generation. So Carrao and Heiser defined three criteria. An individual A modifies its behavior only in the presence of B. If I was giving this lecture in an empty theater, I'd be pretty crazy. Individual A incurs some cost or does not derive an immediate benefit from the teaching. And that A's behavior results in B acquiring knowledge or skills more rapidly and efficiently than would be otherwise. So these are the three criteria that they argue define what teaching is.
The chimps have discovered how to crack open nuts using stones. The technique is remarkably sophisticated, and perhaps more than any other behaviour reminds us of our Stone Age past. Cracking open the hard nut requires the correct toolkit. And they're very careful about selecting stones. One as an anvil, the other as a hammer. Biologists here have numbered the stones to find out which ones the chimps like to use. The anvil must be leveled properly, and then the nut placed without rolling off. Each blow is finely judged to crack the casing without crushing the nut inside. The younger ones, even though they're not actually doing it, seem to be completely absorbed in the activity and watching the others. They only very occasionally get to actually taste the nut. The main reason these young chimps copy the others is that it gives them a sense of identity and belonging. I suppose it's sort of the equivalent of kids playing at cookery. Finally, it's about 2.5. All those shots doesn't really know what's going on. She knows that those stones have some significance. It'll be another 6-7 years before she really develops the technique. And even then, she'll carry on refining it right into adulthood. There are several stages to learning how to crack nuts. First, learn to handle one object. Then, try combining two objects. And finally, put all three together in the right order. The primate hands which originally evolved for climbing trees now can order and manipulate objects, which changes the way their brain works. And the clue to this is that, like us, chimps are either right-handed or left-handed. For us, a preference for using one hand or the other reflects a very important step in the evolution of our brains. The two halves became specialised, and that specialisation allows us to develop language, imagination, and all our creative skills.
And so what I find particularly interesting in this example was, I mean, she said that the organisms are doing this, the chimps are doing this for a sense of identity. Like, what on earth does that mean? What scientific evidence is there for that? She's also implying that the individuals are directly observing and copying the behavior of the others in terms of breaking these nuts. But she also mentions it takes 6 or 7 years for the juveniles to do so. So is that really plausible, that these individuals are actually copying the behavior of others? Or is it that because the others have the nuts and the rocks in this environment, that the individuals are learning via trial and error just with these objects over 6 or 7 years to do it themselves? That's a very important distinction. Whether you observe another individual and really understand what it's trying to do and copy that, as humans can do, or whether, as we find predominantly in the animal world, that individuals are learning individually, independently, but it's socially facilitated because, of course, these nuts and rocks wouldn't be there were others not performing this behavior. They're very different aspects of learning. And so tool use in general has often been considered one of, as she mentioned, one of the driving forces of the evolution of large brains. And we naturally think of tool use as being very important for hominid evolution, as I'll discuss later. However, we find many examples in the animal world where not only do individuals use tools, but in this case, there's what's called meta-tool use. The individual uses one tool to access another tool that allows it to get the reward. And again, of course, this is sophisticated, but not an organism that's comparable to a human. And so here it uses one tool to get another one, a longer one, which allows it to then get the reward. The shorter one would not have done the job. And so again, there's a temptation to think, well, this is a corvid. They're notoriously smart animals. You know, so perhaps also tool use has been very important for the evolution of their brains. But tool use can be found in other places in the animal world. Here, these weaver ants are using their larvae as tools to create silk to tie together these leaves. So tool use itself is not indicative of the organism being complex. And a really nice example of a very complex, sophisticated behavior is also shown here in these ants. What the ants do is they create a structure over the branch with holes in it, and they sit in wait for other insects to move over, and then they'll simultaneously jump out and grab it. So they've made a trap to catch prey. Now, if we ever saw a chimpanzee making a trap collectively, digging a hole, hiding it with branches, and waiting for prey to come over and grabbing them, we would be absolutely astonished. But, you know, these animals clearly can do so. But we would never argue that an ant is as sophisticated as a chimpanzee. So there's something very specialized about this ability within these insects. And there's something much more general about the intelligence that we find in corvids and also primates. So tool use has long been considered a hallmark of cognitively advanced species, but we have to bear that in mind, that you know, simple organisms like ants also use tools. But what role has tool use had in the evolution of intelligence? Still a very open question. So tool use, along with language, cumulative culture, and excessive prosociality, are all candidate traits that may have promoted the development of the unique human intelligence. So in animals, including us, does tool use enhance the evolution of traits associated with abstract reasoning? Has tool use really been the thing that generated, like starting to use tools, did that really generate the expansion of our brains in evolutionary history? And why do we see such little evidence for non-human animals for social learning of tool use? It's extremely difficult, for example, with those birds to train them to use tools. And one particularly informative study came from the study of this animal, the rook. Again, a corvid, a very smart bird. But rooks have never, ever been seen using tools in the wild. They have a huge range, a huge distribution, and they're very common, but they've never been seen to use tools, ever. However, if you take them in the laboratory and give them the option to use tools, this is trial number one. The animal has never experienced this before. So it looks at the apparatus, it knows that there's a reward there, and it chooses the stone to get the reward. And you can see now the apparatus has changed. That big stone will no longer fit. The animal chooses the small one. So it's clearly capable of using tools, extremely capable. Yet they've never, ever been seen to use tools in the wild, which is very surprising. And so clearly in this example, the animal is very capable of using tools, but tool use presumably has not played much, if any, role in the evolution of its large brain. So here we now see two different types of tools. And the animal will, it's got a sort of physical intelligence. It's got an understanding of how physics of the world works. So these animals are capable of tool use. They're clearly capable of innovating and finding the right tool for the job, and yet there is no evidence of social learning, or evidence indeed that they use tools under natural conditions. And so they will even be able to manipulate structures to create hooks, for example, to access rewards. So these results support the view that tool use was not the driving force behind the evolution of advanced physical intelligence. They're capable of it, but clearly it was not important to their evolution. Rather, in corvids, it appears that tool use is a useful byproduct of a domain-general cognitive toolkit. So these animals I mean, compared to ants, who can, of course, use tools also, these animals have a generalized intelligence, much as we do. And so whether or not species actually tap into their capacity to use tools under natural conditions may depend on their ecology. And of course, someone somewhere may indeed observe rooks using tools in the wild. It hasn't happened yet. So they certainly don't do so often. So if we consider teaching, if we go back to the example of the chimpanzee, there is no evidence that mothers behave differently in the presence or absence of their young. So she was arguing that they're teaching the offspring. If they're doing so, then you'd expect them to behave differently, perhaps to perform the task more regularly or more slowly in the presence of offspring to convey the knowledge to the offspring. But she doesn't. The mother does not do so. So there's no sense, there's no evidence that this chimpanzee is teaching its offspring. Now, there is some evidence in other animal systems that some form of teaching may be important. For example, in meerkats, who have to deal with deadly prey such as scorpions, the mother does tend to change her behavior depending on the age of her offspring. For example, she will actually take the sting off the scorpion. The scorpion is still alive, and offer the prey to her young. She's got no idea. I mean, she's evolved to do this. It's not that she's consciously doing this. And the probability that she'll feed the prey intact with sting increases over time. And the probability she feeds them dead decreases over time. But there's, again, no concept that she's aware she's doing this. She has evolved to do it. She's evolved to change her behavior over time. But she doesn't have any understanding that her young are young or older. So it's a different type of teaching. And so here you can see the probability that the prey are lost decreases over time. So the offspring are clearly benefiting from this behavior. So it's a case of the adults modifying the environment to support individual learning. Much like the chimpanzees, by having the stones and the nuts there, it modifies how the individuals learn. But it's the individuals learning. It's not that they're observing others and then able to know what to do by observing others. Again, with Lucy Aplin's work, she's been able to show that individuals can observe others and learn from them. But it's surprisingly rare in nature. Another nice example that's been credited to teaching is the example of these ants. This is Leptothorax albopennis. And what's happening here is one ant knows where a food source is or knows where a new nest site is, and it will go back to the nest and recruit another individual. And this other individual follows it in what's called tandem running. So let's look at that again. So the individual in the front is the knowledgeable individual. And she will wait for the antennae of the other individual to touch her, and then she'll move a little bit in that direction. But she'll always wait for the other individual. So she's paying a cost. It takes her much longer to get to where she wants to go, but it's much more likely that the individual who follows her will then learn the route. She will learn the visual landmarks associated with that route, and she will then be able to convey that knowledge. So it's a form of teaching, but again, very specialized. So ants that know their route modify the journey when accompanied by a new follower. They don't keep stopping unless they're being followed. And they keep stopping specifically to allow the other to catch up. So this causes a fourfold decrease in the leader's speed, or a fourfold increase in the time taken to get to where she wants to go. But it allows these naive individuals to learn landmarks along the route, and therefore to acquire the knowledge. So again, it's a form of teaching. So we shouldn't think of teaching as being specifically a human trait, but it's a very different type of teaching that we're dealing with humans. So the follower can benefit by finding the nest of food, but it's not able to generalize this knowledge. It's very specific to this particular behavior. For example, it doesn't allow them to find food more effectively in the future and doesn't result in cultural knowledge over time, the transgenerational knowledge that is an example of human and some animal cultures. So when we deal with teaching among humans, of course, we have much more specific knowledge. I mean, you're just observing children. It's nothing at all like observing primates, even adult primates. Children are absolutely amazing at copying others. Organisms other than humans do not do this. Even babies are able to imitate faces. So it's something really ingrained in our evolutionary history. And what's particularly fascinating is the culture that humans have. So again, as Lucy Aplin described, animals can have culture. You can have transgenerational knowledge of how to solve a problem. But the culture that we have is way beyond any other animal. And one of the interesting aspects here, we can ask ourselves, well, what is the fidelity of information transfer among humans? How high is it? We have a sense that, you know, there's something special and unique, and so you'd expect it to be very high. And so if you actually look at correlations between parents and offspring in humans, so how like your parents are you in your habits? How like your parents are you in your entertainment and what you enjoy doing in life? And for example, how like your parents are you in terms of your interests in sport? So if culture has got this high fidelity of transfer from one generation to the other, we may expect these to be very high values. But in actual fact, these are extremely low correlations. You're actually very unlike your parents in these factors. However, if we look at other issues, for example, attitudes towards feminism, this now becomes very high. So clearly there is transgenerational information. Political affiliation, extremely, extremely high. You are very, very likely to vote as your parents voted in the past. And so I think I'll finish here today, and then in the next lecture, we'll discuss the big and complex issue of the history of human culture.